From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, ET Experiences. I'm to interview an extraterrestrial. Here's what's happening. The leaders of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee issued a bipartisan statement rejecting President Donald Trump's assertion that the Obama administration tapped his phones during the 2016 presidential campaign. Remember, he tweeted that he was wiretapped. The top Republican in Congress, the House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan, added his voice to a growing chorus of lawmakers saying there was no sign of a wiretap. Now, in a testy briefing with reporters, the White House spokesman, Sean Spicer, forcefully defended the president. Now they're backtracking a little bit, though, saying they meant surveillance, not necessarily wiretapping. We shall see. President Trump's first budget blueprint is calling for the elimination of federal funding to a host of arts and humanity programs as the new administration seeks to redirect taxpayer dollars to defense. The blueprint released by the White House proposes to eliminate funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which sends lots of money to PBS and National Public Radio. Longtime Donald Trump confidant and Republican operative Roger Stone, who's been on Coast to Coast, claims he's the target of an assassination attempt ahead of next week's congressional investigations into the Russian hacking scandal. He was on a book tour in Orlando when he was T-boned in a hit and run. He told InfoWars' Alex Jones that it was done by deep state actors in an attempt to assassinate him. Now, we talked to Roger a little bit today through Jerry Corsi. He said he was too shaken up to get on the air tonight, but we shall see what we do with him in the next coming days. More than 21,000 pounds of frozen pizzas are being recalled due to possible listeria contamination. Here we go. Now, if you bought the pizzas from Walmart stores, listen up. They're made by a company called RBR Meat Company, and the pizzas were sold at select Walmart stores in 50.6-ounce boxes containing single, shrink-wrapped 16-inch pizzas. There was a code on it, 20547. 20547. Well, it seems like a scene from a sci-fi movie in Ghostbusters. The only difference was that the ghosts that apparently showed up at the official residence of Brazilian President Michel Temer seemed scary enough to force the president and his family to leave the palace. Speaking to a magazine, he said he believes the palace is haunted and he wants out of it. Google is trying to improve the quality of its search results by directing review teams to flag content that might come across as upsetting or offensive. Let's check in with the expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. How are they going to flag that, Lauren?
Yeah, it's an interesting advance. I think it's been long called for, too. I'm really glad they're going this way. Let me give my quick Google disclaimer first.
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
I have consulted the Google in the past. I'm not doing so now. Everything I'm saying now is my own opinion or public info. So there's
very good.
Okay.
Now go for it.
Okay, here's the thing. You have to understand a bit about how Google search ranking works. When you look at an SRP, a search result page, those ranks are based on a multitude of factors and signals, all kinds of things. So what Google has done now is they have added for their search quality raters, and most people probably don't even realize that Google has search quality raters. These are people scattered all over who basically spend all day going through search results, and in a very formal, structured way, there's a manual of rules, they rate search results. They can't actually change search results, but these are additional signals that Google uses to decide what the quality is. What Google has done now is added this additional flag, which is called upsetting offensive. So this is different than like spam something that's illegal or something like that that you might find slipping into a search result. And the best example for this that we could use would be when recently there was a lot of controversy when searches for the Holocaust, the top result turned out to be a Holocaust denial site.
Right.
And you know, this was obviously a false piece of information, but also tied to anti-Semitism, tied to racism, very upsetting to people. So the goal here that Google has is to give this additional flag, this additional capability to their quality raters, so when they see search results that fall into that kind of category, they can be reported. And again, it won't automatically change anything, but it's a way Google has to try to improve the quality of search results overall.
Interesting. Thanks, Lauren. Lisa working on something. A team from the BBC and a number of tourists have suffered minor injuries after being caught up in an incident on the erupting volcano of Mount Etna in Sicily. Well, the next time you look in the mirror, take a look at your nose. Because according to an international team of researchers, your nose was an adaptation of local climate. No matter what the shape is, it has to do with local climate. Up next, Dr. Tim Ball joins us. We're going to talk about climate science next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Hey, by the way, the head of course, the Office of Management and Budget Director, Mike Mulvaney, called climate change research a waste of your money regarding proposed cuts in that area. Let's check in with Dr. Tim Ball. Tim is a renowned environmental consultant, former professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg. He's with us for a couple hours, and we're going to take your calls next hour. Lots of people talking about the weather these days. Timothy, welcome back.
Well, thank you, George, and thanks, as always, for the opportunity.
Continues to be very controversial, the subject of climate change. Why?
Well, because it was used for a political agenda. And then that's what's been driving it. And Mulvaney's comment, by the way, is it's true up to a point. The real problem is that they only funded one side of the research. They funded the research that proved that CO2 and human-caused global warming was real, when, in fact, what they should have done was fund people that the skeptics that were showing that it wasn't. And of course, part of the whole point about science is that scientists speculate or create a hypothesis, and immediately other scientists attack it and try to disprove it. You don't try to prove it. What happened was, because it became a political vehicle, they set about proving it, and they enforced that by not funding people that were would normally challenge it. For example, in Canada, just to give you an idea of the extreme this went to, in Canada, all funding from government is done at arm's length agencies. For example, science is done through the Science Foundation, medical research, and so on. But all climate research was funded through Environment Canada, which is the equivalent of your NOAA. And the money only went to people that were going to prove what the government wanted people to believe. And so this is why it's been such a contentious issue. And Richard Lindzen at MIT said it years ago. He said the consensus was reached before the research had even begun. And, of course, then what happened was, as the evidence came forward, despite the attempts to control it, the evidence kept coming forward that showed they were wrong. They either attacked the people, like myself, called me, you know, global warming skeptic, climate change denier, or they altered the data, as they did on several occasions, or they created false data in order to perpetuate the message. So it's what happens when science is used for a political agenda, and it immediately becomes corrupted, and the apolitical and amoral nature of science and the search for the truth, as I know you're so correctly focused upon, just goes out the window.
And a lot of people, I think, Tim, confuse climate change with pollution. Because I don't know anybody who would stand up and say, I'm for pollution, you know, let's pollute the planet. I think everybody wants to clean up the environment.
Well, exactly. And of course, this is an example of the incorrect terminology. I mean, President Obama was talking about carbon pollution. Well, first of all, it's not carbon. Carbon is a solid. he was really talking about CO2, mm-hmm. which is a gas. And CO2 is not a polluting gas. And one of the things that has pleased me about what Trump is doing is that he said, look, I don't want to get rid of the EPA. We all need clean air and clean water. And what he's dealing with is, of course, the political corruption that's gone on, the using of environmental issues and climate, as I said, for a political agenda, for control. But one of the things I'm worried about, George, and I know you and I have talked about this before, is that when people start to find out the extent to which they've been deliberately deceived on these issues, then the credibility of science is going to go out the window. I mean, it's already under a lot of pressure because of people, the funding directing mm-hmm. things and so on. And I think this is a real threat to environmental issues. And, of course, one of the things that was outrageous was the people that were pushing the climate change, global warming, were basically saying, look, we care about the environment, you don't. Well, how dare they do that? How outrageous is that? I talk to farm groups all the time, and there's nobody more concerned about the environment than farmers because they live in it. It's their livelihood, and yet here they're being told that everything they're doing is wrong. And of course, this was part of the political agenda, was to take the moral high ground and to then effectively what I call eco-bully people into believing the message that they were pushing.
Do you think, Tim, that mankind has had anything to do with increases in temperature at all, or are we talking about Earth cycles?
We're talking about Earth cycles. The amount of, on a global scale, a long-term scale, humans have had no effect whatsoever. We have had local effects, and I'm talking specifically about the urban heat island. We've known since about 1933.
Well, explain that. Explain what that
is. Well, okay. We've known since about 1933 when they were doing studies in the Ruhr Valley and discovered they were actually studying trees and studied and found the trees were functioning differently than the surrounding countryside. And then they realized it was because an urban area is warmer than the surrounding countryside. And then in 1956, a professor in London put a thermometer on his car and drove through the city of London on different diagonals and discovered that the city, and particularly at the center of the city, was warmer than the surrounding countryside. And I did studies back in the late 60s in the city of Winnipeg in Canada. And Winnipeg's a pretty cold city. And on occasion, I found that the center of Winnipeg on a cold February night was up to 12 degrees Celsius warmer than the airport just 10 kilometers away. So there, we do affect in a local, concentrated area, but on a global scale, no, there is no evidence. And part of the difficulty with that, George, is that you cannot separate out the human signal because we have so poor measurements and understanding of the natural signal and natural variability and the cycles that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So it's a minute fraction and within the error of what we know about natural variability.
Who was the very controversial former Canadian politician, former Canadian oil businessman? He's dead now, Maurice Strong. Why does his name keep cropping up?
Well, Maurice Strong is a very, very interesting character in the center of all of this. He was born in Oak Lake, Manitoba, to a socialist family. In fact, his aunt, Anna Strong, was an openly declared Marxist, and that's fine. She's entitled to her political opinion. But she actually traveled to China and communed with Mao Zedong back in the 30s. Hmm. And of course, in Canada, socialism was very, very strong on the prairies during the dirty 30s and the hardships. But Strong then moved to the U.S., as you said, became an industrialist, made a lot of money in the oil business. But his socialism kept coming through. And he became a member of the Club of Rome. And the Club of Rome is really the center of what's been going on. Because what's interesting is their issue wasn't global warming or climate change. Their issue was overpopulation. They argue, the Club of Rome argues that the world is overpopulated and it's using resources at a rate that is simply not sustainable. And of course, that was based upon the old Malthusian, Thomas Malthus's idea that the world population would outgrow the food supply. Well, the Club of Rome believed that the world population would outgrow all of the resources. And so Strong, in conjunction with the Club of Rome, decided that not only was the population growing and using too many resources, but the industrialized nations were the immediate problem because they were using resources at a faster rate than all the other countries. So, for example, in the early studies they did, in fact, at the end of the Second World War, the U.S. was 6% of the world's population, but using about 42% of all the resources in the world. And so Maurice Strong, in an interview with Elaine Dewar in a book called Cloak of Green, she said, well, you know, what's the problem? And he said, well, the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And of course, one of the things about people that have huge global influence is, you and I, George, we have ideas, but the number of ideas that we actually put into practice, you know, or the number of ideas that ever get put into practice is a fraction. But one of the things about people like Maurice Strong is they're able to manipulate the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating thing about famous people. You know, Lord Acton said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, but the sentence that follows that says that most great men are bad men.
He used the United Nations quite a bit, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Strong. Well, when Dewar said to him, look, if you want to shut down the industrializations, why don't you run for politics? And he said, you can't do anything as a politician. She said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to go to the United Nations, and I'll actually read the quote from her book. He said he could raise his own money from whomever he liked, appoint anyone he wanted, and control the agenda. And, of course, that is one of the things that Trump is attacking, is this UN agency that is really unaccountable for what they're doing, and yet they're influencing global policy. And Dewar, after 5 days with Strong at the United Nations, she concluded, Strong was using the UN as a platform to sell a global environment crisis and the global governance agenda. So in other words, he decided that the UN was the way to deal with it. And that's another important part of this, George, because he had to have a threat to the whole globe, something that transcended national boundaries. And of course, the global warming issue, and you could read about this in Alexander King's book of the Club of Rome in 1991. He said, we settled on global warming as the issue. And the argument was that no one nation could deal with the problem. It had to be a world government that would deal with it. And that was, of course, what Strong was setting up.
What do you think, Tib, in terms of the cycle change that we may be in? In your opinion, as a climatologist, what is actually happening to the planet? I mean, is it getting cooler? Is it getting hotter? Are we going to have more, you know, volcanoes? We've got problems at Mount Etna now in Sicily. What's going to happen to the planet?
Well, I'll preface my answer, George, by saying that in 1990, there was a conference of world climate people, and the Eastern Bloc at that time, Soviet and Chinese, they were saying, no, the climate's cyclical, and all you got to do is figure out all the cycles and how they interact with each other, and then you can predict, get a better idea of prediction. The West was into chaos theory. Now, many of your listeners will know about that, and of course, they were basically arguing that the weather's chaotic and therefore unpredictable. And at the time, I used to tease them, saying, look, you better hope you're right because your forecasts are so wrong. But this, that was, it was interpreted, those two different opinions were interpreted by the media and people as a political difference of the Cold War. when in fact it was a very real difference in terms of the science. But to answer your question, when you look at the cycles and the patterns of the cycles, the main thing that controls the weather and the weather patterns are the solar cycles. Now, one of the things that Strong did...
Hold on for a second, Tim. We'll get back into that when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Tim Ball with us. Tim, I'll let you finish up, and then I've got a million more questions for you, especially why is there such a disparity between those who believe it's man-made climate change or those who don't? Just got an email from a friend of mine, Richard Green. He used to be a talk show host years ago and ran for political office with the Green Party. He is vehement that this is man-made climate change. He wants you to debate Bill Nye, the science guy, and Neil deGrasse Tyson and people like that. But I'll let you finish up and then get you in to answer those questions.
Yeah, well, of course, it's that level of the vehemence and almost to the level of religion. And that's one of the problems with environmentalism that I talked about earlier, where people taking the moral high ground. And of course, that's been exploited. And science doesn't work that way. Science has got to stay dispassionate and stick with the facts. And in fact, recently I was in Australia with Australian Senator Malcolm Roberts, and we're saying, look, don't tell us what your computer models are telling us. Tell us show us your empirical evidence. And of course, there isn't any. But back to my point about Maurice Strong, and you and I, George, have talked about this before. So many conspiracies in today's world originate because governments are trying to hide something or they've deliberately hidden something. I used to think that commissions of inquiry were wonderful vehicles that finally we get the politics out of an issue and we'll get some professional people looking at it and coming forward with a report. I got disabused of that with my appointment to the first commission of inquiry over a lake in Canada. And what happened was that the minister announced that we're all going to have a commission of inquiry. And of course, then the politician's off the hook right away. Because the media come around and say, well, what do you got to say? Can't talk about it. We've got a commission looking at it. So they're off the hook. Meanwhile, what they do is they go back to their office and work together with their bureaucrats to craft terms of reference which predetermine the outcome. And, of course, that's what Maurice Strong did. And, by the way, I should tell you, the first time it happened to me, with that lake study, I told the chairman of the commission, you either go and tell the minister we get full open access to everything, because we couldn't even get the data we needed to research, or I'll go to the media and say the minister is trying to predetermine the outcome. And by the way, one of the biggest conspiracies, as you know, on your show is the Kennedy assassination. And I was watching Justice Warren, before he passed away, and they said to him, well, why didn't you look at the mafia connection in Dallas with Jack Ruby? And he very calmly said, it wasn't in my terms of reference. Well, I knew what he was saying, but most people wouldn't know what he meant by that. And what he was saying was, I basically was told, don't go there. And this is what happens. And what Maurice Strong did, he wrote the terms of reference for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That is the group that was set up by him to investigate climate change. But let me read you the actual what he actually wrote.
Sure.
Because he said, the definition of climate change that they were given at the Rio conference in 1992, a change of climate which is attributed directly or indirectly to human activity that alters the composition of the global atmosphere, and which is in addition to natural climate variability. But of course, that's what I said to you earlier. You can't possibly determine what impact humans are doing if you don't know what's going on naturally. But by giving them that definition, he narrowed their focus down to only human causes of climate change. Well, there are very few. And one of them, of course, happens to be CO2. But it leaves out the sun.
Well, did we not, Tim, have higher CO2 levels during the dinosaur age?
Oh, yeah. There's no correlation between CO2 levels in the atmosphere and global temperature. And we've got that over a 600 million year record. And in fact, what we did have was around 432 million years ago, we had 4,000 parts per million in the atmosphere compared to 400 today. And yet we had a very big ice age going on. So there's no correlation. And that of course, is part of the problem. And the way that they get around that, of course, is they say, well, we're only looking at the human portion. In other words, we're only looking at it from the beginning or pre-industrial revolution, because, of course, they want to point the finger at industry as being the cause of change. And one of the illustrations that you have of how corrupted the science is was that up till about 1998, the global temperature was going up and CO2 levels were rising, and that was fine. But then after 1998, the global temperature started to level off and, in fact, went down slightly. But the CO2 level continued to increase.
And isn't it true that the solar system has gotten warmer?
Well, the whole solar system is changing all the time. I mean, this is one of the pieces of evidence that people keep pointing to, is that you see warmer on other planets with melting ice caps and so on, and yet there's no CO2 involved. And these are all parts of the bits of evidence that keep popping up that they have to find their way around. They have to ignore them or, as I say, come up with some phony solution. So, for example, we knew the global temperature had decreased from 1940 to approximately 1980. The global temperature went down. And we kept pointing this out to them and saying, look, this is the period, the post-war especially, when human production of CO2 increased the most. But the global temperature went down. So what they did was, they kept adding stuff into their computer model until it achieved a reduction in temperature. And what they did was they said, oh, and of course, it's always got to be a human cause. Humans have got to be the blame for everything. And they said, oh, it's because humans are producing sulfates, and the sulfates in the atmosphere are blocking the sun, and that's what's causing the cooling. The problem with that was that after 1980, the global temperature started to go up again, but the sulfate levels continued to increase. But this is the difficulty. You see, they keep having to make up stories to explain away evidence that doesn't fit their theory. And it's all brought about because, as I said, Maurice Strong narrowed the definition of them only looking at the human cause of climate change. I'll give you another example, George. When we talk about greenhouse gases, there are three major greenhouse gases. There's water vapor, CO2, and methane. All right, water vapor is 95% of the greenhouse gases, but all you hear talked about is CO2.
That's right, which is 0.04, I heard.
Well, it's 0.04 of the total atmosphere, but it's only 4% of the total greenhouse gases. And the way they got around that was they said, okay, well, yeah, humans produce water vapor or, you know, the greenhouse gas. We produce it, but the amount we produce is so small relative to the total water vapor in the atmosphere, it's of no significance. So they just assumed that water vapor in the atmosphere was essentially constant.
If you went back historically, would you find seasons that had big floods, many tornadoes, horrible hurricanes, things like that, even in the past?
Well, of course, you see, that was what triggered me to what was going on, because my study is reconstruction of past climates, historical climates. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that you realize is that the climate changes very dramatically all of the time and in surprisingly short time periods. I mean, if you take from 1900 to the present, the global temperature increased from 1900 to 1940. In fact, it increased more in that 40 years than it did in the current warming. And then from 40 to 80, as I said, the global temperature went down. From 80 to 98, the global temperature went up. Now it's going down again. And that's just in 100 years of record. But people are not aware of long-term climate. And, of course, again, to give you another example, they keep telling you, oh, it's warmer than it's ever been. The truth is that in the last 10,000 years, we've been in a period called the Holocene. And for most of that Holocene of 10,000 years, 9,000 years of it was warmer than it is today. And so you don't have to look very far back in the historical record to see warmer periods than today, colder periods than today, more extreme weather conditions than today. And it infuriates me. I mean, the guy did it on Fox News where he said, oh, Chicago has gone the longest without snow this winter ever. Well, I mean, I love to get on and say, but the world's four and a half billion years old. Do you really mean ever?
Well, you know, I was in St. Louis for the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. It was frigid out. As soon as I left, temperatures went up to 70. In February, people.
Well, obviously, you're the problem, George.
It was me. It was my fault.
Exactly.
This follows me. Why did Massachusetts sue the EPA?
That is a very, very good question, and is part of the manipulation of the whole process. You see, they wanted the one of the things that Strong did. And I'll get around to your question in a minute, but one of the things Strong did was he's a superb organizer, but he knows that you can control a government through its bureaucracy. Mary McCarthy, the social commentator, said bureaucracy, the rule of no one, the modern form of despotism. So when he set up the IPCC, he did it through the World Meteorological Organization, which is a UN body that's made up of all the weather bureaucrats from every country around the world. Okay, and he knew that was how to deal with it. Now, Obama, of course, wanted to have control of CO2, wanted to reduce CO2 levels, but knew that he wouldn't get it through the Congress or the Senate, just as they were not able to get the Kyoto Protocol through the Senate. And so what he did was he end-run the legislative process and put it in the hands of the bureaucrats. And what they did was they got the state of Massachusetts to sue the EPA for failing to control a harmful substance. They said that the EPA's job is to protect us from harmful substance and control those harmful substances. So the Massachusetts sued EPA. EPA lost the case, and in my opinion, they lost it deliberately. And I've gone through all the file records, and of course, it then ended up in the Supreme Court for adjudication. Justice Scalia said, why are we looking at this? We're judges. What the heck do we know about science? Who are we to decide? That was his first problem. The second problem he had was that the lawsuit was filed under administrative law. Administrative law was brought in for the way that bureaucrats deal with the government and with the people. It's a separate branch of law. And so the ruling was under administrative law. The Supreme Court had to say, yes, under administrative law, the EPA is required to control harmful substances. But the problem was the Supreme Court failed to point out that it was the EPA that decided that CO2 was a harmful substance. They were the ones that designated CO2 as that. And it's part of that thing we talked about earlier about CO2 being pollution. And so these were the kinds of games that were played. And of course, the EPA was on the verge of basically shutting down 13,000 industries seriously limiting the CO2 output of 13,000 industries across the U.S.
Why is it? Finish up, and then I got a question.
Yeah, well, the politicians stepped in because the minute that jobs are threatened, that's the one thing the politicians will react to.
What happens if you're wrong and people who believe, as you do, you're all wrong? What happens to the planet? What happens to us? If you're wrong.
Right. Well, okay. That falls into the category of what's called the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is a favorite vehicle of the environmentalists and the global warming advocates. What if you're wrong? And you can apply it to virtually anything. And the difficulty with it is, and I actually had the experience of this before the Canadian Parliamentary Committee on Ozone, and I realized they didn't understand how science works. Scientists speculate about things, and as I pointed out to them, I can come up with hundreds of speculations of impending doom. You as politicians can't deal with all of them. You have to decide which ones you're going to deal with, and how do you know which ones are a priority? And of course, this is why they always push the precautionary principle and say, well, no, we should act anyway. Well, no, you act upon the basis of hard science. And one of the things that Maurice Strong did when he wrote Agenda 21, which was the United Nations Environment Program, of which the global warming was part, and he wrote in what was called Principle 15. And if I can just pull this up quickly and read it to you. It actually states... hang on.
That's right. Get it later after the break.
Well, yeah, okay.
It'll be better for you. Okay?
You want to take a break now? And then,
No. It comes up when it does, but let's do it after the break. You'll have time to look for it.
Yep, okay. But basically, he built it in as Principle 15, and what it says is you don't need scientific certainty to act. If you determine that the planet's threatened, then you've got to act.
If you were able to poll every climatologist, what would the percents be that we're dealing with man-made climate change versus a cycle?
It's hard to say, but the majority would not go with the cycle. I know, but that's part of the difficulty. You see, one of the things that they push this number of 97% of scientists agree. Well, it's simply not true. What they did was they got 11,000 papers and looked at them, and based upon the abstract, they said, "Oh well, this person promotes global warming." In fact, what by their own definition, it was less than 0.3% that agreed. And the difficulty is that so few scientists have actually looked at the scientific reports of what they say. And I'll just read a quote for you when we get to the precautionary principle afterwards, because it's very, very important. But this is Klaus Eckhart Pools, who was a German meteorologist and physicist. And he said, 10 years ago, I simply parroted what the IPCC told us. One day I started checking the facts and data. First, I started with a sense of doubt, but then I became outraged when I discovered that much of what the IPCC and the media were telling us was sheer nonsense and was not even supported by any scientific facts and measurements. To this day, I still feel shame that as a scientist, I make presentations of their science without first checking it. Scientifically, it is sheer absurdity to think we can get a nice climate by turning a CO2 adjustment knob. And that was a basis, as I say, based upon somebody who actually looked at what they were saying.
All right, Tim, we're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but we'll also take phone calls with people who agree with you and some who do not.